do we perform under stress?
Sometimes there's a lot of uncertainty.
This is performance-enhancing psychological skills.
How do we mentally prepare ourselves?
If you express that you're stressed, there's a stigma that you may not be confident.
We deal with crisis situations every single day. This may be one of the most important podcasts. Welcome everyone to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. In this podcast, I have my other three colleagues, outstanding EM and critical care superstars, Dr. John Greenwood, Peter W., and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. Gentlemen, how are you this podcast?
Doing fine.
Doing great as well here on the West Coast.
Yep, the Northeast is hot and steamy, but I love it.
Well, we certainly hope everybody is enjoying their summers here in North America. Definitely the heat has settled in. And this podcast, we're really excited to be talking about a topic. It's not a technical topic, but it turns out this may be one of the most important podcasts we've talked about in many, many months and many years. And that's really thinking about that resuscitation. How do we mentally prepare ourselves for that critically ill patient, the management of that patient? In essence, how do we perform under stress? And within emergency medicine, within resuscitation, within critical care, we deal with crisis situations every single day, every shift. There's a degree of uncertainty. Patients' lives hang in the balance for many of these resuscitations. Often we need to take immediate action and we're really unable to control all aspects of the situation. So we are constantly under stress. And as many of you have listened to social media podcasts over the past 1 to 2 years, you've heard this concept of mindfulness. And it's been widely discussed, presented at national and international lectures. And we'd like to tackle that topic and provide you some of our own pearls along with pitfalls and really to serve as the foundation for our discussion this podcast. There's a wonderful article that's in press in the Annals of Emergency Medicine by Mike Lauria, other colleagues, one of my colleagues and good friends at University of Maryland, Dr. Rory Spiegel. And the title of the article is Psychological Skills to Improve Emergency Care Providers' Performance Under Stress. As we'll go through the article, hit the highlights, you'll see that they provide some really helpful hints to think about and get yourself prepared for resuscitating that next critically ill patient. But gentlemen, before we jump into the specifics and hit the pearls of the article itself, I'd actually like to take a step back and ask each of you, that base station goes off, EMS is inbound in maybe 3 or 4 minutes with a critically ill patient. It could be of anything, cardiac arrest, a post-arrest, could be potential massive PE, hypotensive, respiratory distress. They're sick and they're inbound and you've got just a few minutes to mentally prepare yourself for that resuscitation. Peter, let me turn to you first. What's going through your mind when you hear that or someone's out front in the waiting room and they're being rushed back? What are some of the things that you do to prepare yourself for that resuscitation?
Right. That's a great question. And, you know, traditionally, when we get major traumas coming in to the charity system, what we would do is pull the team together while we're waiting for the patient and go over some key quality points. Again, incorporating nursing, physicians, respiratory, everybody on board to understand the multidisciplinary approach to it and maybe some of the pearls that we've been working on, some maybe airway pearls that fell apart on the last couple of resuscitations that were brought up in patient safety conference or concepts of critical care that we think are most meaningful that are hot topics so that everybody's on the same page. We establish relationships so everybody knows who everybody else is because we'll have rotating interns, residents from surgery and people from far and away coming in so that the nurses feel more comfortable with who's in the room and who to address questions to as we move forward with the resuscitation. So again, setting an environment to foster a shared mental model, I think, is something that we try to do.
That's a great way to start this discussion off in terms of that shared mental model. Rob, let me turn to you. Regardless of the location we practice in, we all have these patients. What do you do personally to get yourself ready to successfully resuscitate that patient?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's a fantastic topic, super important. And as you've indicated before, this is everyday stuff for us. And so in addition to the things that Peter mentioned, it's very important, yes, to prepare the team. You know, it's a communication with the team members and identifying who's going to do what is absolutely vital. In addition to that, I like to, in my head, develop a checklist, really, basically a structured list of things that I'm going to think about with this patient. We typically will have a ring down and some notice of what the patient's coming in with. And so I will basically prepare in my head a checklist of things that I'm going to make sure that I don't forget to do. And I will share that with the team leader, the resident who's running the team. For example, trauma is very algorithmic, and we get tons of trauma at my hospital at San Francisco General, but not all trauma is the same. For example, if a patient's coming in with what appears to be isolated head trauma, I'm going to talk to the resident running the resuscitation, a list of priorities to look out for to kind of redirect the resuscitation from a general algorithm to a more focused algorithm on the head trauma. So really, for me, it's all about anticipating what's coming and developing kind of a checklist in my head.
Outstanding. John, tell us how you start to approach the situation, the patient's rolling in. What thoughts are going through your head to make sure you're thinking clearly in the resus, you're performing those skills efficiently, you're really oriented to the situation? Do you talk to yourself? Do you go through breathing exercises? What are some tips that you use with those sick patients?
One of the things I learned during fellowship is when you get those unexpected patients, maybe not the one that you know you have 5 minutes, but that code bell rings and you overhear Dr. Greenwood to room 4, you know, that can be a pretty stressful moment internally. And so one of the things I learned quickly in terms of how to manage my stress response, which actually ties in a lot of the principles of this paper, is that I no longer ever run at any point in the hospital, in the ED, or even fast walk. I walk slow. The fact of the matter is I can get to the room fairly quickly, whether I walk or walk at a fast pace. But by doing this singular physical intervention, it gives me that 30 seconds that I need to recall maybe some of the things that I plan to do going into the room, even if it's just to familiarize myself with the patient, why they're there. I'm very fortunate to work with a lot of great nurses. And as a team, we rely on each other, and the nurses do a great job at doing those initial first steps. And if it's a code, I know they're going to get started on ACLS. But that slow pace, even just a moderate paced walk, gives me time to think, gives me time to breathe, gives me time to plan, so that by the time I walk to the room, I'm calm. I'm not breathing heavy. I'm not stressed out or talking quickly. So one of the things that I've adopted is to always walk whenever I'm going to a emergency situation.
All right. Well, gentlemen, that's a fantastic way to delve into this discussion about simply how do we perform better under stress. And let me circle back now to the article by Dr. Loria, Dr. Spiegel, and colleagues in terms of those psychological skills and to really orient us to their specific paper, their pearls, their take-home points. Two big definitions that we'll kind of state here as we go through this discussion. They talk about stress. So the authors define stress as a perceived imbalance between the demands of the emergency situation and your ability or our ability to meet those demands, where the failure to do so has important consequences to us. We know lots of literature on stress, stress performance, performing under these crisis or critical situations is detrimental to our ability to perform tasks efficiently and effectively. We know that stress leads to a decrease in the quality and effectiveness of our decision making, decreases in the number of pieces of information that we're able to process at one time, and also short-term memory deficits. And so how can we get over that? Specifically, this paper and what we'll highlight as we move through this discussions is this concept of psychological skills training. It's been used for many, many years in military settings, in high performance athletics, in the performing arts. many of these areas use these psychological skills training, but it's relatively new to medicine. And they define this psychological skills training as the systematic acquisition and practice of different psychological techniques to improve cognitive along with technical performance. So what are those psychological techniques? John, let me turn to you first. Let's just talk about resuscitating the critically ill patient. It's stressful, but give us some background that we can then launch into the psychological skills.
So I think managing a really, really sick patient is similar to any crisis, whether it's a life crisis, a crisis at home, or a crisis at work. Sometimes there's a lot of uncertainty. The patient gets rolled in by EMS. You don't know a lot about their background, what's going on, why they're here. We rely on family members or EMS to give us history. There's certainly always a potential that a patient could get sicker, and that can be stressful in itself, knowing that that patient in front of you could potentially not make it through their visit to your emergency department. There's often a push to take immediate action. There's a number of people looking to you in terms of asking, what should we do next? And then it's nearly impossible to control every aspect of your resuscitation. And while you're in the heat of the moment, you need to determine fairly quickly, you're going to triage which steps need to be done quickly compared to others. So there's two features of the contemporary stress theory seen in emergency medicine. And the first one is an appraisal mechanism. And this is essentially how you approach a situation will often determine your thoughts, behaviors, and your physical reactions that basically lead to your emotional response. And then there's the compensation mechanism. And that's where individuals apply various conscious and unconscious modalities to compensate for your perceived inabilities to meet situational demands. There's also the degree to which your compensation mechanism occurs to determine the nature and the magnitude of the stress response that you're feeling. So these two different mechanisms are at play as you're approaching a really sick patient and trying to figure out what you're going to do next.
All right. Well, I can't overemphasize that enough, what you said, John. And I have to, as a young faculty member, I remember sitting in, it's probably one of the ASEP conferences, listening to Greg Henry. And I'm certain I'm going to get this wrong, and I'm certain I'm quoting the wrong literature. But I think he quoted something from Shakespeare, something to the effect of, there is nothing in life, either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And so important, getting back to this stress response, how we internalize and respond to that situation so often affects and how we're thinking about it, our behaviors, whether we successfully are able to perform the tasks that are critical to saving that patient's life.
No. I think that's absolutely true. And beyond that, even the next step is that your team perceives often takes on these same characteristics that you're expressing, even if you're not even meaning to. I think it just goes to show how important this topic is, because not only are you affected by this internally, but externally, your teammates feel the same exact thing. So that's a great quote, Mike.
Well, I'm going to attribute that to Greg Henry and some Shakespeare quote in some book. All right, Peter, let me turn to you. John gave us a great foundation, but let's talk about now those psychological skills that can help us improve our own resuscitation performance. And Dr. Loria and his colleagues talk about something called PEPS. And what specifically is that?
So PEPS is something that's been used already, as you mentioned, by athletes and performance artists and a number of other people who have complex skills. And really, this is performance-enhancing psychological skills, or PEPS, P-E-P-S. It is really distinct from mindfulness training. It is specifically designed to empower people to actively address their emotional state and to take steps to reduce or to mitigate the stress response in real time. So not if this happens again, but in the moment to do that. What does this allow the providers to do? It allows them to maintain situational awareness. So not just the shared mental model, but an application of the shared mental model and recognition. It allows them to think clearly. It allows them to recall important information or to pick out what is the important information out of lots of information. It also allows them to perform skills efficiently. It's really not designed to replace the traditional clinical training. It's really used as a supplement, an add-on, if you will, a gravy to the meal.
All right. Now, in terms of that PEPS, that was very helpful, Peter, kind of orienting where we're headed. The authors specifically go through four key elements of this performance-enhancing psychological skills that they think are really applicable to the emergency medicine model, resuscitating that crashing or critically ill patient. And they come up with basically an acronym, BTSF. So breathe, talk, see, and focus. And Rob, let me turn to you. And the patient's coming in. Everybody's apprehensive. It's the start of a brand new year. We've got lots of our interns now out and about various units in the emergency departments, rising seniors. Everybody's got some degree of stress response when that patient's crashing. These four elements, let's hit the first one in terms of breathing. Take us through that and some pearls on breathing.
Okay, so remember that breathing is really the only vital sign, the only autonomic function that you can modify, you can intentionally control and consciously modify. So this is going to be the physiologic response trigger that you're going to try and control. So it's all about breathing to begin with. And so providers need to learn to control and focus their attention on their breathing, just as you do in meditation. This portion is very much like meditation, very much like mindfulness. And these breathing techniques can basically be a very quick and effective way to decrease that spike in autonomic and physiological stress and arousal to stress. So we talk about when doing a breathing exercise, there are a number of ways to do it, but one of them is the 4-second method of tactical breathing. And in this, you basically breathe in deeply for 4 seconds of breath. We can go ahead and do it on the podcast here all together. Sort of breathe in deeply for 4 seconds, a slow, deep breath over 4 seconds. Then hold that breath for another 4 seconds. And then exhale slowly for 4 seconds. And then pause for another 4 seconds. And the intent in that sort of 16 cycle exercise is to slow down your respiratory rate and to control that autonomic response and by focusing attention on your breath.
Outstanding, Rob. John, take us through talk. What does that mean?
Man, I'm feeling good now. Okay, so talk is aimed at delivering positive self-talk and developing an internal monologue that can empower you to provide optimal performance. It can improve the perception that you can successfully perform a task. And there's different kinds of positive self-talk. So there's this instructional self-talk. So what this is aimed to do is to keep you focused on the task at hand. So that could be focus on how you're putting the needle through the skin or where you're going to make that incision. It basically draws your eye to a specific task and keeps your mind isolated on one specific thing. Then there's motivational self-talk, which I think we all do this now and then, which is telling yourself, I can do this. I've done this before. Walking through this procedure or this type of patient in your mind, or something like this person needs my help to survive. Something as simple as that can motivate you to perform optimally. Now, there are some specific ways to do this that can optimize how you do your actual self-talk. So the first rule is, in general, keep the phrases short and specific. They're not meant to be broad strokes types of statements. Use the first person. Focus. This is meant to make you better. Use the first person and the present tense to focus on the situation that's right in front of you. Always use positive self-phrases. Never use any kind of bland or negative phrases, because certainly this will impact your performance in the opposite way. Say a phrase with intention. So make sure you're saying it and you mean it. Speak kindly to yourself and then repeat them every now and then. When you're in the middle of it, you may decide, I need to change the phrase, but focus on the next step. So repeat it often, walk yourself through it. And these can certainly help enhance your bedside behaviors.
Outstanding, John. Let's go to that third component of this acronym, and that's C. So Peter, what does that mean?
Well, again, this harkens back to athletic performance and other performance art, which is the ability for the provider to visualize the specific steps of a procedure or a clinical skill that they're preparing to perform. Whether we're talking about an intubation of a difficult airway, whether we're talking about ultrasound-guided central line placement, tube thoracostomy, cricothyroidotomy, again, we want to visualize the necessary steps for these procedures. It does serve as a practice run in the provider's mind, actually before performing the procedure. It activates or uses the same identical neural network as physically doing it. So think about it as intentional practice. It improves concentration, it does strengthen confidence, and it controls emotional responses. The imagery is most effective when it is specific. Vivid details should be incorporated whenever possible, and visualization should include simulating the actual movements, the hand movements, arm movements, and the steps that are incorporated. People use the acronym PETLEP, which is P-E-T-T-L-E-P. The first P is for the physical nature of the task itself. The next E addresses the environment, so specifics of the environment that the task will be performed in. And the first T is the specific type of task involved. The second T is the timing of those individual steps or movements that are linked to the task. L is for learning the content of the movement, so kind of bridges the steps. The last E is emotion of task completion. And the last P is perspective of really the person from a leadership standpoint, what they should be considering as next steps and the overall arching theme for the procedure.
Very, very helpful, Peter. So just to take a step back, we're breathing, we're doing tactical breathing, controlling our respiratory rate, positive self-talk, whether that be instructional self-talk or motivational self-talk. We're now visualizing the steps of a skill we need to do or a procedure we need to perform using as much specific and vivid details as possible, simulating the actual movements and steps. Now, Rob, what's this last component, the F standing for focus? What does that mean?
Yes, so focus is a technique, a trigger word that we use to, at the start of a procedure or beginning of a resuscitation, to basically get you back into focus at the task at hand. We all know from prior literature that stress can cause sort of a negative cycle of introspection and sort of a negative loop, which causes more stress and then a negative loop. And that can interfere with your task at hand and basically worsen your performance. So what you're trying to do is combat that cycle of negative introspection and stress by using a trigger word. You can use that word, you can mumble it to yourself, you can whisper it to yourself, or you can just think about it. And that trigger word is meant to, again, refocus your attention away from that outside stress and to focus on the task at hand. The word can be either motivational, it should be something very positive, or it can be instructional, it can be something for that particular procedure, a step that you need to remember. For example, if you're putting in a chest tube, you may use a word such as pleura, in which you would think about palpating the pleura when you're palpating the pleura with your finger when you're putting in the chest tube. So that word can be, again, motivational, or it can be an operative word for the procedure at hand. And again, you're trying to shift your attention away from stress and negative feedback loops and focus on the task at hand.
Well, gentlemen, this has been an incredibly helpful discussion. I know for almost all of our podcasts, we've focused on a lot of technical things: pressors, when to add them, doses, maps to target, tidal volumes to set, things to monitor. But quite honestly, a lot of that may fall apart if we become overwhelmed with simply the stress of the resuscitation or the stress of the situation itself. And so certainly the things that we've discussed, and early congratulations to Dr. Loria, Dr. Spiegel, their authors on this EPUB ahead of print, an incredibly important article upcoming in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. And just to go over some of those big things once again, we are trying to maintain situational awareness, think clearly, recall important information, and perform that resuscitation efficiently and effectively. And through these four key elements of breathing, self-talk, visualization with seeing the procedure or the skill, and then focusing can really go a long way to help you in performing under that crisis situation, successfully resuscitating that patient. Peter, Rob, any final thoughts as we wrap up this podcast?
The thought I have is this isn't any different than any other virtuoso performance. And this is something that, again, if we take ourselves seriously and think about, we talked about high stakes for the performer, it's really high stakes for the patients as well. And so having this mental imagery, having this focused practice ahead of time is a long time in coming and something we should be embracing and encouraging. And I think you couple that with shared mental models and situational awareness and how we speak amongst ourselves in teams, and there's still a great opportunity for us to improve our skills and outcomes.
Rob, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think those are great points, Peter. I'd like to add that this stress and sort of the arousal and sort of nervousness about resuscitation and these critical things that we do is a natural phenomenon. And I want to emphasize that we shouldn't be embarrassed to speak about this. You know, especially early on in residents and people's careers, there's a ton of stress. And there's kind of a stigma if you express that you're stressed. There's a stigma that you may not be competent or that you're weak and so forth. So I want to emphasize that we should recognize that it's a very common phenomenon, that we should not be embarrassed about stress. We should share our feelings about this and share these techniques with others, especially with our young learners, that we were like that when we were training as well. I remember being intensely nervous about procedures and about resuscitations. And so it's nothing to be ashamed of. And we should talk about it and try these techniques to ameliorate it.
Well said, Rob. Great way to end this discussion. And right before we sign off, just two quick things about amazing conferences coming up in the next few months. In October, as has been the last several years in Baltimore, there's the Crashing Patient and Resuscitation Conference, or Risk Management and Resuscitation Conference, developed and led by none other than Dr. Amal Mattu. The main conference is Wednesday, October 18th, and there's some amazing pre-conference labs and courses on Tuesday, October 17th. So that fills up very, very quickly, a very popular course here in Baltimore, mid-October. Please link to that, the Crashing Patient website, through our homepage on the podcast. And Peter, to round out 2017, what can we look forward to the first weekend in December?
So that'll be Critical Points. And so it'll be a great compilation of some phenomenal educators who will teach us about resuscitation of septic patients, major trauma patients, major neurological emergencies, and major cardiac emergencies, and pediatric emergencies as well for critical care, emergency medicine physicians, as well as hospitalists. So we're looking forward to that.
And I know every year that session or that conference in December in San Diego fills up so quickly. So what we'll ask everyone, if you're interested in going to Critical Points, please link early and go to the website early and sign up, because it will fill up and you'll be shut out for another year. As Peter said, it's an amazing educational experience in December in a wonderful place out in Southern California, San Diego. All right, well, that's going to do it for this podcast. Our thanks to John, Peter, Rob, and then Dr. Loria and his colleagues for an outstanding article once again. If you have any questions, please shoot us an email through the website, and we will talk to you next podcast.